Today is December 29th, 1972, a Friday. The following interview is with Miss Vicki Keller, K-E-L-L-E-R, a member of the Domestic Council. The interview will take place in room 163 of the old Executive Office Building. The interviewer is Terry Good. Questions at the same time, so we've resorted to this, and so far it's worked out pretty well. These questions are very superficial, Vicki. It's just an attempt to get some very basic information from you so that 20 years from now in the library, our researcher going through the files will come across Vicki Keller's name here, Vicki here, and Vicki there, and he's going to say, who was Vicki Keller? What did she do? What projects did she work on? 20 years from now, the staff's not going to know very much. So if they can pull this little resume of this conversation out, that we'll give some of that basic information to the researcher. We feel we're ahead of the game. The existing presidential libraries tell us this is a worthwhile project. It's one they wish they had something like.
Who?
The present libraries, you know, the Truman Library, yeah. Roosevelt Library, we're all part of the National Archives operation, presidential libraries.
I see. And the Truman Library, that's in Independence?
Right.
So where will the Nixon Library be?
Somewhere in Southern California.
Oh, I see.
We don't know yet. There have been several sites under consideration. Our guess is the president has made his choice, but for a number of reasons feels that it's best maybe to postpone announcing that.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who are going out there hope that it's somewhere around San Clemente, as opposed to Whittier. I've never been to California, I have no idea what it's like. But, people tell me Whittier is not quite as nice as San Clemente.
So. You'll be with the library. You're
yes. Jack Nesbitt, myself, and three or four of the other people up here in this office all plan to go out there. So. And we've been here since the beginning of the next administration. So in the course of doing things like this and just our day-to-day contact with members of the staff, we become acquainted with the people, the papers, the general environment of the White House, and as a result, we think we're in a pretty good position to run the library, and I guess time will tell. So, well, let me throw some of these questions out at you. In one or two instances, we already have the information, but it's nice to get it from the person we're interviewing, so bear with us if some of the questions appear rather simple. When did you join the White House staff?
June. I mean, I don't need to have the specific date.
No, just
June of 1971.
And your last day is today?
Today.
December 29th, 72.
Right.
All right. When you say you joined the White House staff in June 1971, I suppose I should have rephrased that and asked when you joined the Domestic Council staff.
Same
thing. Okay.
Yeah.
You were not one of those that came on board early in the administration before the Domestic Council was created.
No.
Okay. Your title while on the Domestic Council?
I had several.
All right.
One was staff assistant to the president.
Okay.
And then associate of domestic council, staff director of the cabinet level of the Domestic Council Committee on Aging, and staff director of the cabinet committee on national birth policy.
All right, I'll come back to these after we get through some of these others. By and large, would you say the papers that are in the Domestic Council files will adequately reflect your activities and responsibilities and assignments? Let's assume that
for the most part.
Some areas probably better than others.
Yeah.
Okay, perhaps as we go through some of the specific projects, we might touch very briefly on whether or not the records related to that are good or bad.
Right.
10 years from now, when we want perhaps to come back and talk with you in some detail, in more detail than you'll be able to do this morning.
10 years?
10 years, 15 years, 5 years, who knows?
Oh, I mean, you do this, you
yes.
plan to do this?
Yes, seriously.
Oh.
It will be a continuing program, hopefully.
Can you explain that?
Sure.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of the term oral history interviews?
Mm-hmm.
Columbia University does this. It was one of the, Alan Evans is one of the men who was a big pusher in this way back when. It's an attempt to talk with the people who were involved in some of the ongoing events, whatever it might be that they're interested in our case, the Nixon White House, to fill in the gaps where, let's say, documentation doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
5 years from now, let's say, we'll go through the domestic council files, read everything we can, let's say, on your activities and your projects. And in those instances where questions arise as to who was the person behind this policy, or how much emphasis did John Ehrlichman give to this, or what was the president's feelings on this, wherever there appears to be a gap in the records, we'll make a note of that and hopefully come back to you 5, 10,
you'll find lots of gaps.
All right. Event,
yeah.
This is the purpose behind the oral history interview, to try and fill those in. Everyone knows that in this day and age, you just don't have time to keep a diary or write everything down. The telephone is the medium by which so much is transacted. So that's the hope of an oral history interview 5 years from now, 10 years from now. In part, we put it off because we think that, now evidently it's been proven true, the person's perspective obviously changes. Some cases for the better, some cases for the worse. Their memory begins to play tricks on them, certainly, so we have to take that into account. But they're perhaps a little more willing to talk candidly about some of these
things.
We have the tremendous advantage that most of the staff members here in the Nixon White House are relatively young.
Yeah.
So we've got 20 or 30 years in which to talk with these people over a period of time.
Yeah.
This was not the case with the Eisenhower administration, so I'm told.
Yeah.
The Truman people also.
That's interesting. You just get on. I mean, this is going to be your project for the next
year. Yeah, hopefully.
Yeah, how exciting.
So that's one of the reasons why we ask, where can we reach you in 5 years from now, or whenever you leave this this assignment. Some people give us their addresses, their parents, their in-laws, the university or college
they graduated
from.
Parents would probably be the best.
All right.
I mean, in 5 years, I know where I'm going to be for sure next year.
Okay.
I have a pretty fair idea where I'm going to be for the 2 years after that.
And after
that. Yeah, then it's all, you know.
Well, why don't you tell them where you're going to be next year, and then for the 2 years after that, and give me your parents' address to boot.
Okay. For the next 3 years, I can be reached in some way, shape, or form through McKinsey & Company.
Oh, in California?
No, in London. I'm going to London.
Oh.
For next year. If plans go as, you know, as we're planning, I will be coming back to New York for 2 years and
again,
working in some capacity with McKinsey, probably, hopefully in a joint venture with another group. And that's as far out as I've planned my life. So for the next 3 years, McKinsey & Company will know where I am, either the London office or the New York office. After that, I have no idea, but my parents will know where I am, and they're fairly young, so I'd say the Kellers, Lewis, Mr. and Mrs. Lewis James Keller, and who knows where they were. The care of Rocky Ridge Development in North Shore of Lake Tahoe is where I think that they will probably.
Is that a mailing address you just gave me?
Yeah, because they, that's where their permanent residence is. They live in Sacramento during the week, but they've bought, you know, purchased a major house there. So that, you know, I feel that they'll be there for a long time.
How about a
University of California at Berkeley Alumni Association, or the Harvard Business School Alumni Association, another one,
Okay, we've got you. You can't get away.
Yeah.
I envy you going to London, oh my.
Mm.
That sounds like a real challenge and a lot of excitement to do. Has anyone been assigned your responsibilities? Generally?
Jim Cavanaugh, generally. I had two areas, national growth policy and aging. And Jim Cavanaugh will be taking aging, and Dana Mead will be taking national growth policy.
Have there been any newspaper or magazine articles that have discussed your activities or your programs or policies in a way that you thought was adequate and informative?
No, all there have been really is a couple of newspaper stories the day that we released the report. It was a good article on Project Find, which is one of our major projects. But my major activities involved, I mean, were culminated in the National Growth Policy Report, which is a public document. The President's Special Message on Aging, which is a public document. And then the implementation of the projects and programs and policies that were contained therein, particularly in aging.
Project Find was
Project
part of aging?
Project Find was a part of aging. It was a major program that was announced in the spring and implemented through the summer, sort of ended in the fall, and it did get a lot of press, and there were articles about it. In fact, there's one outside that you might want to just grab as you go out. But the only real newspaper articles were, you know, President today announced a special message for the aging, or, you know, National Growth Policy Report issued, nothing in terms of an in-depth study, although I have a feeling there might be some articles written on Project Bond in the years to come.
We ask that question because on occasion someone will say, oh yes, there was an article in this magazine or that journal, which may have gotten biased. It's nice to put in the files. And secondly, if a researcher would come up with an article and say, do you know if this article is a good article, a bad article, is it biased, is it complete, is it superficial? If we've heard from the people that have been connected with that, if they can say, ignore that article, or by all means rely upon that one.
Well, there were a lot of articles, I mean, there's different kinds of articles. Lots of articles were written on what the Nixon's program is in aging. But a lot of them we had placed during the campaign.
All right.
You know, so it's all sort of the same material recycling through the same system, coming out a different way, you know.
With that knowledge, though, we'd be in a position to say, by and large, all of the articles that you read are going to be valid in terms of the information, and perhaps
a bit slanted.
A bit slanted, but no more so than you might expect from anything coming out of the administration.
Yeah. So I could say that for the period, you know, in the last year, there have been a lot of articles placed about Nixon's aging program.
National Journal do anything in these that comes to mind?
No, I don't think so.
On occasion, someone will cite National Journal and say they did it. By and large, people say it's pretty good.
Well, I think they did an article. This was when I was not as involved in aging, in the White House Conference on Aging, I believe, around December of 71.
I think I've seen that.
But that's all.
Okay.
I mean, there haven't been any real analytical articles done.
Has Betty Kirschner been your secretary for the entire time you've been here?
No, I've had two. One, Ellen Sanger, was secretary from June to December, and Betty's been from this whole
Ellen
year.
Ellen Sanger?
S-A-E-N-G-E-R. She was Ellen Kennedy, C-A-N-A-D-Y, and she got married. Ellen Sanger.
Would you have a resume that we could stick in this file?
Of me?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do.
All right.
Betty's got it in.
Let's go back and touch base on some of these titles you've had and these two large programs that you've been involved with. Trying to break them down in terms of the amount of time that you spent. Could you give us some percentage figure for the amount of time you spent on aging as opposed to the amount of time you spent on national growth policy? Perhaps the question isn't valid.
No, it is.
We searched for
essentially worked, I'd say maybe 5 months on national growth policy and the rest of my time on aging.
Of the two, which gave you the greatest satisfaction?
Aging.
Aging?
Yeah. National Growth Policy was essentially the production of a report. And it was such an abstract concept, National Growth Policy, so intangible, basically so broad that it was impossible to really get your hands around and do an adequate job. Whereas the aging was very specific. You could touch the problem. It's 20 million people, and they had very specific needs. And what we had to do was analyze those needs and decide what policies were needed to best, within budget constraints, could best deal with them. And you could implement a project like Project Bond, and you could see the results. Within 2 or 3 months, you had more older people on food stamps. You could see pictures in the paper. You knew that you were, in fact, touching the lives of people.
The National Growth Policy Project report, who else was involved in that besides yourself?
John Price was involved in it until he left. So I worked with John from about June until December when he left. And then I took it over as my responsibility to have it issued by the end of February.
During that period of time, had most of the research work and the drafting of it been done, or was it a case where you were getting in at the ground floor and watching it as it reached fruition?
Well, the National Growth Policy had been in fits and starts for many years. It started off, I guess, in about 1970 with what they called a rural development strategy. The president had said, there's all these people leaving the farms and flooding to the cities, and there's something wrong with this because our cities are overcrowded and our rural areas are suffering. What we need is balanced growth. So they put together then, under, I believe, John Price's guidance, and headed by the Secretary of Agriculture. Now this, I'm not sure, this you could get better in the records from John.
I talked with John before he left, and he touched upon some of this, so.
Right, well they went through an elaborate study trying to come to grips with it, and then nothing really came of that. In fact, something did. They had ideas of rural growth centers, at which point all of a sudden this revenue sharing concept came up and sort of eliminated that, and then it stopped for 6 months or so. Then we picked it up again in June, and this time with a more specific objective of developing a report, and scoped out a rough idea of what chapters, what ought to be in a report, what sorts of information was needed, and handed out the assignments to the Census Bureau and HUD, primarily as agencies, plus some other agencies did some minor work. By about December, HUD had a first draft of the report done, and my role then, between January and February, was really in the revision and clearance and production of that report. And I'd say it changed rather dramatically from December to February. And it went from about that many pages.
So you really had to edit it down.
Yeah, and get it cleared through the White House OMB.
What people on the White House staff or the OMB did you run that by? I'm thinking now of perhaps
individuals.
Everybody, but some of the more significant ones.
Well, working the closest with me was calling Bill Hamm from Office of Management and Budget, who was in the community planning area. And he and I worked very closely. And then I had it cleared through Ed Harper's staff. Sensitive parts that related to the various agencies we had the cabinet secretaries look at, agriculture people, etc. But that's all, mostly Bill Hamm from that.
But you were the one that solely was responsible for editing
coordinating
down.
The right. Total process.
And for that period of time, from June through when the report was issued, Would you say that by and large your time every day was devoted to that, or was it one of just many things that you were?
No, I mean, it was from about November, end of November through February, it was 100%, like 300%. But between, I'd say July and November, I worked half-time on aging and half-time on national growth policy. I worked as an assistant to Jamie McLean, who was then staff director of the Domestic Council Committee. My area was totally the substantive side of things, whereas Jamie McLean handled all aging matters, public relations side, political side, legislative side, and I just handled the policy analysis. And then at the point, then Jamie left to become Cost of Living Council Deputy Director, and I took over his responsibilities as Staff Director of the Domestic Council Committee on Aging around mid-February. So from the moment that the national growth, in fact, the day I was in the, up 3 o'clock in the morning, page proofing the pages. And the next morning, at 9 o'clock in the morning, I was up here in a meeting talking about the aging report, which we then thought was going to be out 4 days later. Yeah, I mean, that was that was just hectic.
That was the week that was.
That was the week that almost was me. And then I worked full-time on aging since then.
The report would, for all intents and purposes, document fairly well your activities on this national growth policy thing,
mm-hmm.
and the files related to it. So if we wanted to do a research study of that and your input into it, by and large, the files would give us enough information, adequate information.
I think, if you were to take what the report was when it came from HUD, and I'm not sure I even have that on file. I may not. That would be worthwhile getting, perhaps. It's that thick.
This is the one that you eventually
we got,
down.
Yeah.
Where would we find that? Is there just one copy of that somewhere?
No, there were lots at one point. Betty may have it. If not, they might have it. You might call over. I mean, it would be worth it as much as, it would be a very revealing study. To take what it was, and it would really reflect, it would show the Nixon philosophy, and it would be an interesting study on how the White House relates to the agencies and what the disparity of viewpoint was, because it was really, they came over and it was sort of a, typically what HUD has been, their storyline, mm-hmm. what their beliefs are about urban development, you know, and it was just sort of antithetical to what administration believed. And if you could compare that with what the final report was, you could see a lot of what the tension was between bureaucracy and the White House.
You mentioned HUD. Would that be the same case with agriculture and commerce and the other
departments? Well, the report was basically, the first draft of the report was pulled together by HUD, having a study team of resources from agriculture and commerce. But HUD came over with a report that thick. It was sort of a heart bleeding, you know, the cities are going to hell and we're going to hell and, you know, the blacks are caught in the ghetto and if we don't get everybody out in the suburbs, you know, we're never going to save the country, that kind of thing. And that just wasn't what, I mean, it wasn't just blacks in the suburbs, but, you know, the environment stinks and, you know, it was one of those things. And everybody here said, oh, that's not what we want to say. So it would be, I mean, it is an interesting piece of history.
Would there be supporting documentation in there, or would we simply be working with the initial HUD report and the final report, and we simply have to draw our own conclusions about why it was cut down this far?
Yeah, because the way it was cut down was basically, you know, a circulating process which went to, you know, through OMB, draft after draft, you know, and all of a sudden, X this out, don't want this here, why don't we reorganize this? And, you know, we went through maybe 6 full drafts within 2 months.
And all of these inter-office memos would not be...
They weren't inter-office. They were basically a draft.
Oh.
That was
and
then
everybody
just...
went through it.
Just went through it, and then we wouldn't even have it, because then my secretary typed, you know, it crossed out, written in between the lines, you know, change this to such and such, this page ought to, you know, little arrows, this page ought to go back here. There wouldn't have been any memos. There might have been some, but not many. It was mostly, you know, draft from draft to draft to draft.
If we got a hold of the initial one, got a hold of the final copy, could we then, as I say, come back to you and say, okay, Vicki, this particular chapter, as it started out, doesn't compare at all with what ended up. Could you explain to us perhaps the reason behind why it's modified?
Yeah. But I think if you really should, for historical purposes, get a hold of it first. You know, I mean, it'd be painful. Well, it's one of those things that, you know, in 10 years, everybody could talk about. Right now, it'd be way too sensitive, you know.
Again, that's why we postponed these interviews for 5-10 years for that reason.
Yeah, I mean, but it was, in terms of the history, it's fascinating to see how that report got down to what the National Growth Policy Report was and what went on between the agencies and the White House.
It wasn't a case that it was just made more concise. It was literally a case of
Well, in their words, it was castration.
HUD's view.
HUD's view. That we emasculated, castrated the report.
I look forward to doing some research on that and talking to you again about that.
Yeah, but you better get, let me just see if Betty's got it. At one point I had 10 whole things over here. Hi, do we? I know, isn't it funny? Would you see if in the files we have a copy of the first draft of the HUD National Growth Policy Report that came over from? You remember that? Remember that? All 89 chapters? Okay, the whole thing. If we don't, HUD's probably got it in their files. You should contact Fred McLaughlin at HUD.
At HUD?
Yeah. I'm sure they have one set. But you could just get their final, they did two drafts. You should probably just get their, you know, their final draft they sent over here, which I think has 7 chapters maybe, including new policy initiatives were about that thick. And you'll notice in the final report there's no chapter on new policy initiatives. And they sent over a chapter on problems that was about that thick. There's 4 pages in the final report on problems. Then they sent over a whole chapter called Failures of All Our Programs. And there's no chapter in the final report on that. It's fascinating. That would really be fascinating. I wouldn't mind, you know, doing that myself.
Would it have been your position to have said, look, this chapter on failures, we've got to...
It was a consolidated judgment of, you know, OMB, myself, John Whitaker, Ken Cole, Paul O'Neill. It was basically the executive office of the president, you know, all of the parties involved decided. I mean, I made by myself small decisions, you know, well, let's, you know, about reorganizing this and cutting that down. And, you know, I made a lot of decisions, in fact, but major policy decisions about what do we want to talk about problems, how much, in fact, was made sort of the day before the final report went to the printer, you know, and I had 6 people in the room and I said, okay, you know, we've got 6 decisions we have to make, 1, 2, 3, 4, and that was it. That's how the report, you know, in the final stages came out.
No one person had more influence on that than others?
Well, in a sense, I did, in the sense that I was responsible for the whole thing, and I had to make the judgment about which decisions were decisions that had to be kicked up, which decisions were the ones I could make. I mean, nobody wanted to go,
This is the overview chapter, and this is the...
Go get him a National Growth Report.
Oh, the final?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
Missing chapter. Chapter. Missing chapter 4.
And how many chapters were there? Did I hear you say something about 89?
No.
Oh, now come on. Somebody's playing games with me. You can't be looking at the same thing I'm looking at.
No, I am. This was an overview. We're missing some. This was an overview, okay?
All right.
And this is chapter one, trends and growth. Chapter two, imbalances and distortions of growth. Chapter three, some strategies and issues. Chapter four, which they don't have here. Chapter five, regional, state, local roles. And chapter six, administrative initiatives toward a national growth policy. Chapter six. You're missing here chapter four.
Can we take an optimistic view and hope that that chapter four will be in somebody's file somewhere, or if you don't have it, it probably doesn't exist within
No, I think you ought to call over. If I were you, I'd call over to HUD right now and call Fred McLaughlin and ask for a full set of these. Because this was really HUD's product.
All right.
And I'm sure they have a master file on file somewhere. But if you can imagine what another chapter looks like. And that's... That'll tell you more about this. If you have that and you have the first letter, it's in the files, the memorandum sent out by John Price and myself to the staff, setting up the work thing.
All right.
Then there were a couple subsequent memos, I think they're in the file, where George Romney came over one day and said, "This is our report. I'm secretary I'm the chairman of this committee, and this is my committee. I want responsibility for the report. And if Vicki's going to have a role in the report, she's going to come over, she's going to work for me. But as long as I'm secretary, I want the person that's working the report to be in my staff. And we'll do it, and we'll have it done by December, and then you guys can take it from there and clear it." So that's basically what happened, and that's what basically came over. And then the White House executive office took it over there.
I'd heard some other comments about the Secretary of HUD from John Price.
Oh, Operation Tackle. You probably heard about Operation Tackle.
I haven't looked at the resume I did of that interview recently, so I don't remember everything he had to talk about.
Oh, there's a great thing called Operation Tackle. That's where... Okay, so this was the report, right?
All right.
So the report came, and about the same time, George Romney and company got absolutely enthralled by this idea called Operation Tackle. Total American Community Living Environment. And there's material in the files on Tackle. But George Romney, in his evangelical style, really sincerely believed that this was the answer to the problems of the cities. Of the whole thing, this was the answer to the national growth policy. And that instead of just a policy, which the Congress wanted, he'd give them the solution to the whole problem. So it involved sort of a competition, the amalgamation at a local basis of total metropolitan areas, which is the idea of total community, you know, city, suburb, get together. And they'd bid in a competition for massive federal dollars, billions of dollars. They'd come up with a plan for saving their area, and it would be submitted to the federal government, and Washington people would sit and decide, yes, this is the answer, and they'd give out the prizes, which would be considerable. I think the whole program in the end was $6 billion. And I mean, it was just, nobody quite knew what to do with it. But George Romney was really involved, and he almost made it a reasonable issue. I mean, he forced the issue, he had to go see the president. And leaked it to the press and put the president in sort of an uncomfortable position. And so there was the Tackle phenomenon. And then
did you get involved in that?
Yeah, we got involved in that in the sense that we had to, you know, we really didn't know what to do. I mean, our role was to try and staff out what this was and figure out if the concept made any sense and what the options were, and, you know, figure out what everybody thought about it. And then when he finally insisted on seeing the president, you know, we had to prepare the staff papers to...
Got a working knowledge of Tackle.
Of a working knowledge of the process of untackling.
Untackling Tackle.
But it went from there. I mean, that was one major episode in the National Growth Policy Report. And And then sort of simultaneously we were going through this report. And at the end of the whole thing, very poor, very bad feelings between the White House and, and HUD.
Just between the White House and HUD, or were any of the other cabinet secretaries involved in this?
No, George Romney really got involved. And I mean, he would have meetings with the whole, you know, Domestic Council, National Growth Committee, and he'd have his blue sweater, which is now famous, George Romney blue with royal blue.
Is that right?
V-necked sweater, long sleeve, roll up, you know, have his sleeves rolled up, his loafers on, and pound the table and say, you know.
Would there be records of those meetings?
I think. No, there aren't minutes of the meetings, but there are the staff papers that went for the meetings, you know, that were circulated in advance, prepared by HUD, and circulated about what they wanted to accomplish.
Would we find copies of those in your files or in the Domestic Council files
generally? I think so. I'm going to have to go through and check. I would imagine my files, Ray Waldman's files. Ray's role in this, Ray came in. The way John Price and I divided up the work was that I would take responsibility for the report, and John would take responsibility for the new initiatives. And he spent most of his time in the last days here on a thing called the National Community Development Bank, which was a big scheme for land development, federal financing, federal land assembly, etc. And I took responsibility for the report. Then when John left, John Whitaker gave Ray Waldman the responsibility for the new initiatives, so that Ray would also be a person to talk to in terms of untackling tackle in the National Bank and everything. And Ray and I worked together on that. So in Ray Waldman's files, you probably find this if they're not complete in my files.
I've exhausted my questions on national growth
policy.
Are there some other areas there that you think might be worth?
No, the interesting thing, I think, in national growth policy. Well, I mean, from a historical standpoint.
Right.
I mean, from the substance standpoint, there's lots of very interesting questions. But from the historical standpoint, I think it really illustrates some of the problems, some of the frictions involved between the White House and the agencies, and particularly this conservative administration and the traditional, not even vested interests so much, as traditional perspectives of the bureaucracy. What we'd done was turn the bureaucracy loose, and they created the Bible, of everything they've ever wanted to say to the world, which was just very different. I mean, there were a lot of people down there, the gnomes that were working on this thing, had no dedication to Richard Nixon, had no real understanding of his principles or what it was he was trying to achieve, what his philosophy was, and just went out. And the report, because it was so thick, got cleared, you know, went up through the secretarial cabinet clearance process, in which they're supposed to get out all of those things, you know, so that something that the secretary sends the president ought to be reflective of administration philosophy. And it arrived, you know, and it just wasn't. And there was just some of the things, I mean, OMB, some of the calls that I've had with OMB were just cracking me. So let me read you a sentence. And it was saying something, you know, like, you know, and if we ever get out of this goddamn Vietnam War, we'd be able to save the cities. You know, and he said, somebody over there in HUD ought to be strung up by the thumbs to be able to have that kind of thing get through. You know, a criticism of the administration on various policies. Well, maybe we're, and I think we tend here to be a little bit paranoid and too sensitive to criticism and tend to think that everything that the administration publishes ought to, you know, put us in a good light. So there was a little bit of that. We have to take that blame. But that was the interesting thing about national growth policy, to see this conflicting of viewpoints. And it was also a little bit exacerbated by George Romney's evangelical zeal. I mean, he did get in and he did get committed to this, and he took it, his ego got involved. And so it created a considerable amount of tension between the White House and the executive office. I mean, and I. But that was it. I mean, that's the story of national growth policy.
Sounds like a very exciting thing. Glad to get your views on it.
Yeah.
We should come back to you in a couple of years and we're in a position to talk in more depth on it. Well, moving on to aging. You were the staff director of the Cabinet Committee on Aging.
Domestic Council Committee on Aging.
The Domestic Council Committee on Aging. Jamie McLean.
Jamie McLean was from about, I think the committee was formed at around August of 71. And Jamie was the staff director at that time. Until about February of 72. There are memos in the files concerning the creation of the committee and the specific mandate. There are then a number of papers, very detailed staff papers, as we were developing our strategy for older people. From August to November was an intensive diagnostic research development stage, culminating in a series of options papers to the president concerning what his major programs ought to be, all centered around the White House Conference on Aging. That was sort of the focal point. That was the impetus. Here was going to be this group of delegates coming to Washington and telling the president what they wanted him to do, and we wanted to think through in advance our position to those various recommendations so that we could have an impact, so that we could put the president in a position at the White House Conference of saying a speech that would outline where the directions are and be able to announce a few initiatives, and that we'd have a perspective so that we know that he'd announce a few things at the White House Conference, and then he could announce a few things at the aging message, a few things at the State of the Union, and that they would all fit within a general strategy. So you'll see in the files a very, very good, maybe four papers. You know, you can see the evolution of our thinking and how it started from just, you know, we were all scattered out there and then sort of pulled things together more until we got down to, I think, a very excellent sort of 50-page statement of strategy and what the broad program options were and the cost and all that. That's
and this is what went to the president?
Yeah. So that all culminated in about the end of about December 1st. Then I was off on national growth policy and Jamie full-time. And then during that sort of hiatus while I was on national growth, basically, Jamie went through, well, okay, this is what we've decided now, what's next? You know, scoped out kind of a plan of action for you that there'd be an aging message in March, and then that we'd had a federal response to the White House Conference recommendations in one point of time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, gearing up, and what should the Administration on Aging do? The president announced he was going to quintuple their budget from $20 million to $100 million. You know, those kinds of issues. And then he left, and then I took over at the point at which the major thing facing us was the aging message. And as I said, I had thought that the day that I'd gotten through with the National Growth Report that I was going to have literally 4 working days to put together a message on aging, and I just about died. But we got to postpone that, but it was unfortunately, the message went at the end of March, so I really had a month, but I never knew it. I mean, we kept postponing it a week at a time, so he kept getting all geared up, all fired up, and you know, and then you know, staying up till 3 a.m. to find out it's going to be another week. It was those 2 months were the worst months that I spent here, from February to March. So what that involved, basically, first of all, I had to get the legislation, the basic legislative package that was going to be sent to the Hill, which were the amendments to the Old Americans Act, the issues relating to them resolved with OMB, the conflicting forces between OMB and HEW. And then we had to develop and clear the aging message, and not just so much the writing of it, working with the speech writing staff on that, but the new policy initiatives involved. You know, developed, okay, we developed our context last time, and we knew sort of what we're trying to do. Now, of those various things, what are we going to do? And I worked very closely in this with Arthur Fleming, Dick Darman from HEW, Bill Robinson from OMB. I worked for Ken Cole, but didn't really see very much of him. That's about it. We had some relationship with the committee to re-elect the president, Dan Todd. Oh, and Bud Evans here and Chuck Colson's staff. But really very little. I mean, they didn't really get involved in the specific policy decisions.
Were the policy decisions arrived at rather democratically between you and Fleming, Darwin, and Robinson? Again, it was more or less your decision as to what you wanted to discuss with those people, and...
Well, it was a process by which I had set up ground rules with Ken Cole that sort of anything where there was general agreement with everybody, we'd go ahead and do. Where there was any kind of a conflict with, you know, the agencies on one side, no one being on another side, or all of them together and me opposed, or, you know, any variation thereof, that I would escalate the decision to Ken. And if need be, if it was a big decision, we'd escalate it to John, and we'd have to go to, you know, the president. So it was sort of like that. So it was a, you know, not to say democratic, it wasn't where you go around the room and say everybody raised their hand, but, you know, we tried to work things out amongst ourselves as best we could. And those decisions that where we were just opposed, we'd send upstairs for decision. So that the aging message really reflected a series of policy decisions made at various levels through the month of February. And that, you know, if you get the aging message, you'll see what all those decisions were. And I believe there's a staff paper articulating some of the decisions. The biggest decision was the Social Security, 20% Social Security decision, which is not in any of my papers because that one was so involved. But that was one of these decisions that sort of was go, no go, we're not going to do it, we are going to do it, we're not going to do it, until finally we've definitely decided not to do it. But, you know, in terms of who got involved, all the people zipping in here and zipping in there, and, you know.
Everybody can take a little bit of credit for having been involved in that.
Yeah. I mean, any of the major, really major decisions around here that have been made have just been incredible to watch. I mean, the number of people that get in the president's ear at various points in time.
The files obviously then would not reflect very well all of the thought
on the
discussion.
It reflected my little bird's eye view of the Social Security issue. But to get the full impact of that, you'd have to get the OMB files. You'd have to get Jim Falk was involved in that more than I was, because he handled HR1, and that was the Social Security thing. You'd have to get the Treasury Department. You'd have to get John Connolly's files. You'd have to get Herb Stein's files. Well, it was basically Schultz, oh, and Richardson. It was Schultz, Stein, Connolly, Richardson, Colson, John Mitchell.
That's a pretty high-powered group. You sitting in there with all those fellows?
No, I was staffing the papers, some of the papers that went up, and watching parade of people go in and out, zipping in and out, saying, well, yes, we're going to do it. No, we're not. Yes, we are. No, we're not. Well, this hour's decision.
You think that if by chance we were able to get the files of these various individuals, we could put something together on it that would give us some video?
President's calendar schedule.
All right.
No, I'm serious.
Well, we keep that.
Yes, that's right. But during the months of, during the merry month of March, about a 2-week period, if you compared memoranda and the schedule of presidents, you'd have an interesting story. of who went in to see him with what point of view. And unfortunately, what you'd have to do then is recall what he said to those people, because the decision changed. And, you know, I mean, it was very, very interesting 2 week periods on a very major issue.
After that particular aspect of it was resolved, and then it went to the Hill, or he announced it? And
then it went to the Hill. Well, a lot of littler, smaller decisions, and then it went to the Hill on the 23rd of March. Secretary Richardson went up and testified. And from then on, largely, we went into an implementation phase with two general types of work. Three, I guess. One was just needling the agencies to do what they said they were going to do. And you'll see I've got charts in the files that say, you know, sort of administrative initiative status report, you know, from each month I'd sort of update it. So that anything that any agency had to do, I would do. And, you know, I just meet with them and say, look, the president announced in March that this is the thing, and how are you going to handle this, and what target dates he's setting, etc. That was one part. Second would be legislation. You know, the president announced he's going to submit legislation to do the following, and etc. And then there were those areas that where there was no specific agency involved, and that's where I had to get involved as being in the White House. And that was how I got involved so heavily in Project Find, that the president had announced. And this was really Arthur Fleming's idea, that we would have an intensive campaign to seek out and find those older people who were eligible for food assistance but not participating in the programs. And we would amass all volunteer resources we could, state, federal, private, and go out for a 90-day period and find these people. You know, that was all fine and dandy to say, but when we sat down and figured out how the heck we were going to do that, it was just an incredible, most complicated, challenging assignments I'd ever had. We ended up, I think, with sort of a really ingenious system of using the Social Security system and their mail to send out in all the things a brochure about food stamps and a return card if they were having trouble locating or, you know, enrolling back to the Social Security office prepaid, which was then sorted by zip code and sent out to all of the local chapters of the American Red Cross, which fielded a volunteer network of about 35 to 50,000 volunteers who would go out and interview these people and help them get to the local welfare office and enroll in food stamps. Well, it's very simple now, but to put that together, you know, well, first of all, figure out what the system was, which, you know, back and forth, but, you know, put together the thing of the Social Security Administration, Department of Agriculture, which had the food stamp program and brochures, OEO, which funded it, the American Red Cross, state welfare agencies, you know, all of this was done through the Domestic Council because it was the only group that could pull together all of the agencies. And that, you know, that was a major program.
How long did it take to develop that process?
Well, from the time the president's message was announced, which was the end of February, till the drop in the August 3rd checks was all planning time. You know, I wasn't spending full time on that. But we didn't really get agreement from the Red Cross, which was the final piece in the puzzle, until about end of June. You know. Took a long time to figure out. But there are memos in the files about that. All the, you know, all the alternatives we looked at.
What was your role in this project fund, Vicki? Were you the chief honcho for it?
Yeah, I was the chief coordinator. Arthur Fleming, through this whole process, was sort of a super aging person, and he had a lot of creative ideas, a lot of leadership, a lot of energy, but he was never here. He was off flying the country talking about aging. So my responsibility was to see that the president's what he said got done. So I had to work with Arthur to, you know, get some general ideas and then go ahead and set up the meetings with these people and argue with OMB for the money and put together the project plan. You know, actually make the thing happen, see that it happened. And I ended up getting a subcontracting out to a management group that did the overall systems planning for the thing. If you can imagine trying to piece together all of these various parts, you know, if the cards are going to drop here, then before that you have to have this, and, you know, working back a very elaborate per diagram, well, that's not the kind of thing I had time to do. So, you know, just mine was sort of the packager to get it all put together, see that all of the agencies were knowing what they were doing and that the money was coming from the right sources to the others, and sort of stay on top of it that way.
Now, you initially you talked about some of the people you worked with on the general agent question. Arthur Fleming, Dick Darvin, Robinson, Ken Cole, Bud Evans, and then on the Social Security question, you named some very specific people.
Right.
How about on Project Find? Are there, is there a
There's a board. There's a Project Find board.
There is.
Yeah.
Would your files reflect the activities of the various members of that board?
Yeah, in fact, I have. Yep, we have. I think I have agendas and everything from every meeting, papers from all the meetings. And yeah, the board sort of evolved with time. It really started with me and Fleming. No, and then we had Agriculture and Social Security Administration, and then we got in OAO because they were going to fund it, and then we got in the local welfare department because they were going to have to worry about the welfare load, and then we just kept sort of moving it out as we got more people. And I think it's been successful. A lot of people have been involved.
But the other people that were
involved... There's been an interim report on FIND, and there will be a final report on Project FIND.
For the people that were involved in this, in addition to yourself and Arthur Fleming, are there some that come to mind who were more involved than others? Or is it a case that they were all involved more or less equally?
No, two people over at the White House Conference on Aging. Byron Gold and Frank Stewart were involved heavily in the early thrashing around stages. The problem is that Byron Gold knows more about aging than almost anybody else, but he can't kind of put it together in a practical sense. So that what Byron ended up doing, you know, he had all these great elaborate schemes, you know, but all these problems, what are we going to do about that? So what finally happened is that, you know, his role phased out as we got in this consulting group called, I think, Bill Crager from Capital Systems Group, from about June on, probably, June or July on, probably has the best understanding then of the details of Project FIND. Because once we'd finalized on the what the concept was going to be, how it was going to work, who the major parties were going to be, then I felt comfortable then. I mean, I turned the whole implementation of that, the details of implementation of that over to this consulting group and said, look, here's how we want it to work. You guys come tell us who has to do what with. And that's so Bill Crager knows the insides and out. And there will be a final report issued on Project FIND, wrap-up report. In fact, of all the things that were happening in aging, it's probably going to be best documented.
Well, were there other projects that you got involved in to a degree that you think perhaps we ought to mention?
Oh, yes.
Again, keeping in mind your time schedule.
Yeah, just this one is the only one. The administration response to the White House Conference on Aging Recommendations, which is going to be, if it's ever published, about a 200-page document.
Did you write that?
Not myself, no. I mean, I was again, the same sort of role I played. No, I was much more deeply involved in the development of this document. What we did, we got it, it's actually the same consulting firm, a group of sort of professional writers to take everything that we had already done. What we had to do was respond to the White House Conference recommendations. And since we thought about how best to do that, and there's memos in the files about alternative ways of doing it, you know, do you respond to them one-to-one, or you take the whole thing and say, well, here's the general thrust and here's what we're going to do. So we finally decided how we were going to do that, which was some sort of in between there. You know, divide them according to our administration strategy for aging and say what the conference delegates want and what we were doing. So since there'd been so much already written that we had done on aging, we just farmed it out to a group to say, okay, take a first draft, you know, of everything we've written, come back to us. You know, you guys put it together and synthesize it, come back to us. So then they brought us that. And then basically it was myself and Arthur Fleming who almost sat down and sort of rewrote then the whole thing. Come in.
You and Arthur Fleming then went over the...
Literally took the thing and between the two, you know, divided it up. And between the two of us, rewrote it.
It came to you roughly 200 pages thick,
yeah.
And you rewrote it.
Yeah.
What portions of it did you have responsibility for? Is there any way to divide it up?
Yeah, we could. I think it was sort of on chapters. I think I took the chapter on how. I mean, I could take the report and say which parts I did and which parts he did. He did chapter one. I did chapter two. I did most of three. He did part of three and all of four.
There were four chapters?
Yeah, in terms of the rewrite. And then we took the whole rewrite, and then we went back again to the agencies and said, okay, now we want you to verify all of this, make sure that everything we said in the rewriting is all true. And then we cleared it through OMB, and then there were just a whole lot of meetings with OMB saying, oh, well, I don't, you know, this is too strong, this isn't, look at this out.
Were you meeting with any specific people that went
through? Yeah, Paul O'Neill, Bill Robinson, who about midway through this process left, and Cecile Weiss took over for him. Plus a lot of this, well, Pete Rumsey in the housing area. But mostly, and Dick Darman a lot in HEW, he was closely involved, but mostly Arthur and I and Paul O'Neill. And that is still about, you could see, I mean, we could give you the first drafts of this thing as it evolved, but I don't know if it's that important. There's no big story in it as there would be in the National Growth thing. I mean, it's basically taking a document and going through the ordeal of working with it and shaping it and making it into something that's a lot more dynamic and factual and specific.
There isn't much change of policy or substance from the original one to the final copy. It's just
There's a lot more positive. It's just a lot stronger and more positive. But it wouldn't really represent a major. It would represent more Arthur Fleming and I really working hard than anything historical, you know.
More editorial style, perhaps, than...
No, I mean, the policy was... Yeah, I mean, the policy there was buried. It wasn't coming out in terms of a strong statement of this is what the federal government is doing and will do for... That was what we basically did. It was just a whole bunch of recitation of things that would be done, and Arthur and I took it out and shaped it into a policy statement and said, this is the overall policy, and this is the examples of what we're doing, and this is what we're going to do. That's all. Well, anyway, what happened to that is that we decided that maybe we shouldn't release it right before the election. You know, we worked on it. We had anticipated, we wanted to get it out about, you know, August, mid-September at the latest, and then it just, you know, I mean, it went on and on because we kept looking at it and said, this isn't good enough. And, you know, when two people sit down to rewrite a 200-page report, you can't do it overnight. So we just kept working and working and working and working. And then, you know, fighting and arguing. Finally, about October 15th, we had a document that we were very proud of. And then, you know, question, why release it? Why, you know, why send something out that's bound to be controversial 2 weeks before the election, 3 weeks before the election? Why not just wait? So we decided to wait. And then as soon as the election was over, the whole report started quivering because all of a sudden everybody was talking now about new policy things and cutting the budget $11 billion. And was there in fact going to be a 20-fold increase in the administration and its budget? And was there going to be an OEO? And was there going to be this and that? So Secretary Richardson says, look, until I feel comfortable that what this report says is not going to be embarrassing when I have to go there and testify in 2 months, I don't want to release it over my signature.
So it's still just more us biding time and...
It's right there in my file, waiting to go. So, you ought to have a file copy. You ought to get a copy of that. Because...
Hopefully, all of your files, all of the files of the domestic council will end up in the president's library. Now, perhaps that sounds extremely naive and optimistic, but it's according to John Campbell and Bruce Curley and all the powers that be, the files of the domestic council will be going to the president's library along with all the files of the president's.
Yeah.
Does that sound
no,
like
that
we're hoping
fine.
For too
no.
much?
No, I think that's true.
Too much?
Yeah, the thing is, there's only one copy of that now. I just have to get more copies.
Oh.
I mean, you know, we had it limited edition because we were waiting to 200.
So if and when that goes to Richardson for his signature, then will that?
Oh, no. I'll have more. I mean, I'm going to get more now because I've got to circulate these because somebody, Jim Kavanaugh's going to have to take it over from now. But what you see there, what you will see in my file will be the report as of fall.
Oh.
What you then see released will be what happened. I mean, it will be very interesting. I mean, the important thing here will be the catalog, the shift, or whatever. But it will be that will be the state of the world for all folks as of September 1972. And then you'll have something in writing to see what happened between September and February or whatever. And I don't think I could probably say that there will be no area in domestic policy that you will have had cataloged in such a rigorous, fully developed fashion what policy was at a point in time.
God.
You know, and that's really, it's a compendium of everything we were doing, were planning to do, had done, all organized according to administration philosophy for older people. With the rhetoric, with the specific facts, with specific targeted dollar amounts, as of that point in time, it'd be fascinating to compare that with.
Your contacts with Arthur Fleming throughout all of this, have they been face-to-face, over the phone, frequent, infrequent?
Frequent.
Over
the phone, in person. At 8 o'clock in the morning on the telephone on a Saturday, at midnight on a Thursday. Arthur Fleming is a phenomenon, really.
I've seen him. I've never been introduced to him.
He can wear out 5 people.
Is that right? It's very deceiving that his appearance would lead me to believe, or at least did, that he's an elder statesman who he doesn't look like he has that vigor and drive.
With the energy of a madman.
Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, literally, he was on the plane the whole time around the election, you know, for 3 or 4 months before the election. He was only in town maybe 2 days a week. And he was literally on a plane. Sometimes he'd come in from California and go back again, come in and out. And I'd be sitting there, and Betty'd call, it's Arthur Fleming, and I'd pick up the phone, hi, I'm in the airport here in California. I will be in. We had a system for about 2 months, or about a month, it seemed like 2 months, when we were doing this report, this, you know, rewriting this, where he would call me, you know, in the morning, and he'd be somewhere in the West or the Midwest, and he'd say, I'll be in the office by 7 o'clock, my plane is taking the plane now, I'll work on this chapter on the plane, but I think it needs this sort of thing, we'll get together. He'd come into my office at 7 o'clock, we'd sit down and go over the morning news, you know, what had happened during the day. He'd go sit in the VIP office down there with his little two-finger typing system and retype a draft of the report, and then we'd get together about 11 o'clock and go over it and stuff, and then he'd say, okay, I'll call you tomorrow. He'd go off again in the morning, and he'd call me from someplace in the Midwest, you know. Guy's a wonder. He'd come in again at night, you know, and he wasn't sleeping, he wasn't eating, I mean, he was just really dedicated man.
In the course of all this, did you travel much?
Mm-hmm. Very little.
All of your work was done pretty much here within the EOB or the White House. You didn't get out to any of the agencies, either for national growth policy or AG, either one.
Oh, I went out one
know, just done one quick trip out to California to look at a retirement home. Spent 2 days out there, but not much.
What's your background on all of this, Vicki? Now, don't laugh, but...
What do you mean?
In terms of, did you come into this job with some either previous experience or tremendous interest in either of these two areas, national growth or aging?
No, I came in, my expertise, the reason I was hired for this job was that I was 5 years as a management consultant in sort of the on social issues, where I would be given, my first assignment with McKinsey was in consumerism, and they said, you know, here's this association of grocery manufacturers, they have these complaints from consumers on this, food boycotts here, FTC hearings on deceptive advertising, etc. And they don't, you know, what is all this? Ralph Nader, what is all this? So my job was to come in and take a look at, quote, consumerism, and tell them what it was, what its various components were, what the forces were, what the options were. I did that in consumerism, I did that on solid waste disposal, other forms of pollution, housing, so that my skill was to be able to come in and take an area and scope it out and say, okay, here it is, and here's what you can do. And so I did that. I also had 2 years of housing development work in this job, so that was logical for national growth policy. But that was basically it, you know, sort of taking any problem and getting involved in it.
Was this work done with the McKinsey firm out in Los Angeles?
No, I was in New York.
You were in New York?
5 years, yeah.
You got your degree in California?
No, I got my degree from the University of California, Berkeley.
Yeah.
Then I went to Harvard Business School for 2 years.
Okay.
And then I came
all
to
right.
New York. For 5, and then down here, and then London, and then New York.
You're starting to talk about Gardner Fleming now. Well, I don't have to thank you for all this information.
Oh, you're welcome.
This has been fascinating. I apologize if I've taken too much of your morning. This is one of the fears we always have, is that we're going to burn somebody out during this, what we call preliminary type interview, and the next time we call him 5 years from now, they'll say, oh, don't let him in again, I couldn't get him out of the door.
Oh,
so,
I love to talk, that's one of my problems. Well, one of the things I guess I've been very open with you here.
Well, I appreciate that.
I don't know, you know, in a way I almost feel, as you say, I'm too close to the situation now, and I sort of feel, a couple times through this thing I thought, I've sort of had this flash like I may be talking to somebody from the press, and you know, I can't.
This is the president's property,
yeah.
It's administratively confidential, and as far as writing the resume of this up, I'll write it up in such a way that some of these things that I feel perhaps we're sensitive, I'll either leave them out. It's just a very superficial resume that
yeah.
we do. And you'll get a copy of it and you'll have yeah. a chance to look it over.
But I mean, but seriously, things like, you know, the conflict, I guess, between protecting the president, you know, when you're working for him and when you're not working for him, and you know, letting history be seen as it was is a real one. And
5 years from now, when we get back together, I may say, well, during that first interview, your position on this was thus and so. What's your perspective on it now?
Yeah.
And
because this whole national growth thing, you know, was, we really didn't want, I mean, we wanted to present to the world the fact that this is how the administration felt about national growth policy. But in fact, the administration was split right down the middle. And all the people over there felt that way and very strongly, and all the people up here felt that way, and this whole process of 2 months was just tug of war, in which we, you know, in the event, of course, the White House triumphed. But I think that's a valuable thing to see, a valuable piece of history.
I'd almost go so far as to say that that process that you went through on this particular problem was not all that unique.